bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Bryce Castillo, joined, as always, with Andrew Main.
Hello, folks.
Brian Brushwood.
See, you did good. That was good, Andrew. You said the words. You showed up.
And Justin Robert Young.
Yay.
we were talking just before we went live about the fact that Andrew is recovering from surgery, so Bryce will be taking point on this episode.
That's right.
Yeah. Oral surgery, Andrew, guys. Nothing weird.
Yeah, nothing weird.
I'm excited. I'm excited you're here.
Yeah. Well, and I'm glad that you're here too. We need some aquatic experts for our first story here.
Man, if only one of us had a prime time special about, you know, doing underwater stuff on a major cable network.
Yeah. In fact, we'll let him guess last because he's most likely to get this. Gentlemen, I'm going to show you. This is a photo of a white tip shark off of the coast of Kona, Hawaii.
Man, I was hoping the question would be, what is this creature?
Oh, I'm sorry. First off,
shark. I can tell Fred, it's a, yeah. Fred, shark. How are you, Fred?
There's a story. There is a story hidden in this photo. Brian, can you describe the image for me and see if you can figure out the story here?
There seems to be three things worth noticing. You have a shark and it's near not a what, a zebrafish, I think.
Looks like it.
There's a couple of creatures attached to the side, but they're too small to be remora. Remora are those kind of bigger fish that just sort of ride along. They almost look like snails. Wait a minute. Nope. I also see weird circles. Did this shark fight an octopus? Are those octopus six rings on it?
Wrong cephalopod. Wait.
There was a real life shark versus squid attack? Is that what happened?
This believes to be the first recorded evidence of a shark and squid fighting. Yanis Papas. Oh man, I should have practiced this word. Papas de Machau. And sorry about that.
Oh
Yanis.
My God. Okay.
Describe the apparent interaction.
For the home people,
I'm going to interrupt here.
Go for it.
I'd read the headline for this. I never saw the photo. When he put this photo up, I'm looking at this thing closely. Like, is this a fake shark? Because there are those weird markings. And then, like you, Brian, I had that. Oh.
I mean, we're accustomed to seeing sharks with all kinds of scars, sadly, oftentimes, you know, they're scars from motorboats or what have you. So as a result, when I saw those loops, the first thing I thought of is how they resembled like a six pack plastic rings. And I was afraid is going to be some other, you know, boohoo for plastics story, but that's a dope story, man. That is definitely a tentacle that wrapped around and squeezed.
Yeah. So for the audience, you see rows of suction marks. You see the faint outline of where the lash part of the tentacle, and then a couple puncture points, which would be from the center of the tentacle. Like, it's, as fingerprints go, it's a GD squid.
These are squids that we still, I mean, obviously have not gotten full, like, photographic evidence of, and all we really know of its existence are when their tentacles wash up onto the shore, right? Is that
correct?
Yeah,
we've seen, like, corpses show up. Like we know that true deep-sea squids exist. We found pieces, or I thought one or two has washed up. And I want to say that a year or two ago, some Japanese scientists got, you know, that basically Sasquatch-looking footage of what, you know, of a real one. Mm-hmm. But dude, to see the straight-up slap marks across the face of a shark.
Well, and that's the thing, is that it's not necessarily even the issue that they fought. It's that the shark is alive, right? Because I'm sure that there's been many of squids that have fought sharks that for which the sharks don't live to tell the tale.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So right now they cannot conclude exactly what species of squid fought the shark, but they do believe it to be a giant squid. Quote, it had to be something pretty big.
I'm reading from the science report, it says that squid was pretty dope. What a badass. To take on a shark like that. Whoa, bro. Wow. I'm going to do a bong hit. It's me, a scientist. Official statement.
I want to show you a photo. This just show you how badass the sharks are at handling pain. My first dive into shark infested waters. The first thing I saw, this is no lie. This is no, you know, this is no documentary. Let me just jump to the chase. The first thing, once we hit the bottom of the ocean, I look out there and I see these two great whites, and you
notice
the one in
scars?
Front.
Oh yeah, there's a huge scar on the left side of the larger
Jesus.
Shark there. It just looks like loose skin. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it looked like a zombie shark, right? Looked like another, and presumably it was another shark had bit him, and they're like, we've never seen this. And this is shark. This is, if you watch Discovery Channel, these are the two brothers. Because they're seen around all the time. You know, they hang out with each other, which sharks
constantly
don't do,
looking for Heisenberg.
Yeah, exactly. But that's like, it's like sharks don't do that. But they did that. And then when I went down there, Andy Casagrande was all excited. He's like, oh my God. Because he's like, we just shot them a few days ago. That guy didn't have that scar. I'm like,
oh, so something went down in the intervening moments. And that is a fresh scar. And that is not something that. Oh my God. Yeah. I guess I hadn't even thought of like, you don't normally see big flapping skin off a shark like that, right? Like this is its own. Oh, that's terrifying.
Mm-hmm. It's a new reality show. Shark snitches.
Captain Kipper in the chat sent along this video of a giant squid being captured.
No, that's
on
a
imagery.
Lady. She's talking about some marine stuff.
Very. You could.
There we go. So, shark, you know, this, in terms of, because I mean, this doesn't, we don't know what type of squid, we don't exactly know for sure who, was the aggressor here.
Who started it.
Yeah.
About somebody's girlfriend or like, you know, whether or not there's a problematic thing there.
Here's what we now know, that both sharks and squids can snap. As they get ready to rumble. That's
why
the real scientific.
Why weren't they the squids? Like the sharks and the squids, I feel like would have been.
You're a squid till the end.
Maybe the squid gang just hangs out like they very rarely seen. You know, you only, like if you cross a squid, like. You have the scars for life. Like,
tentacles flailing with suction cups bend.
So, and so while we don't get a lot of direct evidence here, this also helps in terms of conservation efforts. Ocean white tips are I don't know if it's exactly an endangered species, but
probably threatened. Yeah.
That's right. Threatened. Critically endangered.
I'll tell you who is threatened. Is anyone who wanted to step between those two? When you're a shark, you got rows full of teeth.
And so knowing that they may hunt in certain waters and that they might get into tussles with giant squids help set policy on what parts of the ocean to protect. So, it's a little bit of a shark update.
We got people in the chat who are like picking sides. Sharks, more like farts, am I right? Boo!
Squid gang, hashtag squid gang. Tentacles up.
All right, I got a question here for the panel. We'll go in order here. What do you think the first animals on Earth were?
Animals, full stop?
Yes.
So including like dinosaurs, right?
First ever land animal.
I mean, look, the answer is always a crocodile. They're immortal, they're forever. They're the best. It's always a crocodile.
Always a crocodile, says Brian.
Maybe it's a tiny crocodile. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a regular crocodile. Maybe it's Crocodile Dundee. It's always a crocodile.
All right. Justin?
I'm going to say it's something platypus adjacent. Something, some weird, like marshland creature.
Okay.
Very progressive.
Yeah, all right. Andrew's racking his brain thinking about the correct answer here.
Well, because I think that like when you try to define land animal, it gets sort of weird. My guess, if you were to ask me, like, what would be the first animal I think that probably went towards the land and maybe stayed there for periods of time and maybe even developed sort of the organs, like the organelles for air, maybe like a crab, some sort of crab.
Wait,
okay, crab is a good guess.
Do you think crab over lungfish? I mean, if we're playing for reals.
Well, I mean, a lungfish...
It's just, long enough to get out of water, lay its eggs in the safety, knowing that there's no predators up there on them crazy washy shores.
I don't know. Like, again, that's where it gets hairy. Are we talking about something that just goes and puts its eggs on land? Or, like, because you have crabs that kind of, like, it will live in moist environments and, like, stay outside the water, like in Florida.
Yeah, gotcha.
Does an amphibian count as an animal?
We are looking for the first species that has left the primordial soup. And to live on land.
That is born on land, lives on land, dies on this land.
Permanent home. That's the word we're looking for. A permanent home. Yes, on land.
I know this.
Okay.
The Montanan. Because that's his land. That was his daddy's land. That was his daddy's daddy's land. And you're going to get off that land or we're going to have a problem. Click, clack.
Oh, I know. What? Adam.
Yeah, baby.
I don't see why we made it so complicated.
Checkmate. Made in his image.
So, while many insects are suspected to have ventured off to land for occasional forays, scientists now believe with molecular clock dating, they believe that the myriapod, a relative of the modern millipede, is the earliest direct evidence of an animal living and breathing on land.
Can we talk about the phrase molecular clock dating?
Oh,
it
yeah.
sounds like a very aggressive way for molecules to date. Like, you just,
yeah.
Like one of them walks over, you're like, yo, you want to go on a date? Say no.
Yeah. Well,
I dare you to say no.
There's
hey,
a clock.
Clock is ticking.
It's a speed dating. It's a yeah, speed exactly. dating thing.
Papa, now you want to go on a date. We're molecular clock dating. All right. How big is this critter?
That's a good question. We do believe it has been dated to 425 million years old. That seems to be the new date, which would edge out by other fossils of other bugs and the Campocaris, I believe, is the name of this fossil. So it beats out other bugs by about 20 million years.
How big? My thumbnail, my pinky, the gap between those two?
That's a good question
about
here.
About the size of a maggot?
Yeah,
I would say...
I'm looking at...
Similar to a millipede or a centipede of today. Inches?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a description here on Wikipedia. They talk about the 1 centimeter long fragment of a fossil depicts kneels high in the body, long slender legs. I don't tell you how much.
Yeah.
I guess that makes sense because...
Oh, here we go. Small, 20 to 30 millimeters. About an inch long, the Campocaris.
Boy, that really...
That really technically meets those specifications. Boy, is it
a
technical victory.
If I want to wax a little poetic, Earth pretty much sucked for a really long time. Like, it was either made of fire, then became the world's most boring ocean, and then... I guess stuff got interesting underwater.
Well, here's the thing that's kind of really crazy about geology and even paleontology is that there are periods in Earth's history because if you think of the Earth and that crust is constantly sort of reshuffling itself and recycling itself over and over, there are periods that have happened where you had like enough of that happened or there was massive glaciation that took over the whole planet and you got Ice Age Earth that ground everything down, that you go into certain places and you will see where there is... We don't know what happened. We just see a bunch of ground, like basically rock and sediment and stuff, and like large stretches of time that are these blank slates in Earth's history, which is kind of freaky and weird. You know, like global periods of time when because of just the circumstances, like that's where sort of the idea of snowball Earth, one of the reasons that came from was, you know, periods of Earth's history, the Earth was maybe completely covered in ice.
Hey, along those lines, Andrew, has there been a science fiction series that takes place in a world that is vibrant and alive and interesting and wild, where high-flying adventures of all varieties happen, but also they all happen to be occurring in the virtual world because in the physical planet, somebody looked at their watch and said, oh yeah, it's going to be 1,000 years of ice. What say we all go into pod form, have robots make our children for us. We'll just mainly live virtually. Has anyone done that?
I don't know of that particular scenario.
That kind of sounds like one of the Philip K. Dick short stories where everyone lives underground and robots pretend to have war on the surface of Earth.
I mean, I guess or the closest thing I guess it's making me think of is Seven Eves. Recently, there's the moon explodes, and there's a few different ways people try to survive the next 1,000 years. None of them terribly pleasant, all in wildly different directions. But the idea of like life still being valuable and beautiful and wonderful and relationships being real, just all of it being while our physical bodies are, you know, frozen with eyes closed, experience virtual births, lives, marriages, and deaths. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I mean, interesting premise. You know, you can imagine a civilization that, let's say, they, for whatever reason, like they never, you know, they were starting to have, you know, severe overpopulation issues and stuff, and then they started virtualizing people and not telling them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, we don't want to kill anybody, but we'll virtualize you and you live into the sim or whatever. Like, yeah, there's, you know, well, you can come up with, and it's one of the things that supports simulation theory, not as a factual way, but just as sort of a philosophical, is you can come up with so many reasons for why this would happen.
That, well, and we've talked before about the idea, and I keep coming around to it, is imagine a government that needs to stimulate its economy. And traditionally, there's only two ways to do that. That's to make your money worth less so people spend more, it's easier to borrow or whatever, or to directly fund things or whatever. But I'm increasingly fascinated with the possibility of virtual consumers, because like the idea that no, we're going to build AI bots that are going to go out and judge various things on their worthiness and spend real money on them.
It sounds a lot like the selfish ledger thing that kind of leaked out of Google last year or the year before.
Oh, I'm unfamiliar. Tell me about this.
We talked about it. You'll remember it when we talk about it, but it was a leaked kind of futurism talk about an algorithm that would know what you want and was so interconnected to an Internet of Things sort of ecosystem that, say, it knew that you wanted a scale, and then it would design and build and manufacture a scale that would look and have the feature set that it knew you desired, and it would be built such that you would use it, and it would collect all of that data, and so it would be a machine that would spend your money and build tools and devices and goods that also built itself.
Yeah, I guess
amongst other
things. That's close. I guess the idea of I don't know, chasing them fake robot dollars, which we already do.
Yeah, on, but
hello,
Brian,
welcome to YouTube.
Yeah, well, and Brian, to your point too. Think about an era where you have an algorithm, and to Bryce's point, you know, Bryce has an algorithm. I have an algorithm that I say. Go out there, find me interesting things. And then that's sort of the virtual version of me. And it might go through and watch 500 videos to find the one that Andrew's going to want. And that could be sort of some form of that, you know, because at the end of the day, you have to figure out, okay, I say this, but then I'm going to say Bitcoin sort of destroys my argument. Like, you got to figure out where the value is created. Well, there is no value created in Bitcoin. So, you know, it's effectively it turns energy into, you know, Beanie Babies. So, you know, that's a portion of the economy that works without actually creating real value, but other than some form of liquidity. So I could see that, you know, there could be that, you know, oh, well, I've got, you know, bit followers. I've got 50,000 bit followers. And the more bit followers you have, the more value you have, the more likely real dollars will follow.
Which just sounds like a longer version of social credit at some point.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but it depends, like, you know, if it is it, you know, who is instituting it? You know, there's a difference between, you know, the Fed and Libra, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what we always accept is cold hard cash over at patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah.
But actually in the form of electronic or, you know,
also Bitcoin. We'll take actually Bitcoin.
Cold cash. Hard yeah. electrical cash at
no,
Patreon.
The way that you give us money, there's only two ways. Either you take change and physical dollars and tape them to your computer or phone screen until the Weird Things fairy comes and collects it.
By the way, the only way that works is if every morning you wake up, see that change taped to their monitor and scream, "Why aren't you gone yet? Why are you still here?" And if it's there the next day, it's because you didn't wish hard enough.
Exactly. Or you can go to patreon.com/weirdthings. Established in 1968, this is the new way to give us money from the future. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
1968.
Yeah. Right. You can get a custom RSS feed to get your podcast before anybody else, before it goes out to the rest of the world, specifically the After Things podcast. Friends, if it were any easier, you'd be doing it in your sleep. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Also, this just in.
Eventually.
You literally could do it in your sleep.
Yeah.
You can actually do it in your sleep. In fact, all you have to do is go there once and then immediately go to sleep.
As a matter of fact, you know what? Best thing you could do, pull out your credit card, lay everything in front of you, take 5 Ambien. Whatever happens with your fingers and that keyboard and that credit card information, don't worry about it.
You just let
wake up feeling good.
Yeah, let your subconscious
between,
do it.
That's between you and Mithras.
That's right.
And it's legal too. Whatever happens,
it's a fun
legal
game. Here's a game we like to play. For every Ambien you take, hit another zero, then hit enter.
Yeah,
that's how you win. Is if you can hit enter before you die.
Take the Patreon challenge. Take Ambien, and every time that you are wondering what's happening, hit another zero on your Patreon pledge.
I swear to God, if we become like millionaires tomorrow, I'll feel very conflicted. I really won't know how to feel about it.
But the people paying won't. They won't. They're good.
Well, because what the conflict I'll feel is how much of a commission I need to give to the Ambien Corporation.
Zero! Zero!
Yeah. They have all those R&D funds.
That's off the rack. We don't need to... We don't need to license it.
Hello, welcome to Ambigore.
I'm Jonathan
Ambien. Do you
Ambien.
Remember anything? Well, let's talk.
Okay. Hey, you know what we should talk about? You know, one thing, one of the unforeseen effects of the coronavirus, COVID-19, is that people are, well, how about this? Let me tell you this.
You could say it.
What are
you,
some
you
of,
could say it. Hair's getting longer.
What are some of the silver linings out of
COVID-19? Hair is getting very long.
No, you love your hair.
I mean, ain't nobody said I love it. I'm just saying it's a fact, Jack.
So what are some? So what are some of the other say silver linings out of COVID-19 and a lot of the social distancing, staying at home policies
and
ideas?
Yeah, not having to make excuses to not leave my house. You know,
okay. Easy to stay inside.
Wish I'd thought of this COVID thing earlier, man. Am I right?
Man, I guess silver linings. Man, everybody has an excuse to do anything selfish ever, always. Like, I can't think of a single self-indulgent thing that I know I probably shouldn't indulge in. I mean, like I might start trying heroin because COVID. I mean, why not? It's COVID.
And for legal reasons, that is a parody. So
yeah, it's not a thing.
Okay.
Won't try heroin.
Okay, so a little
but
more.
But he might. But he won't.
Also, maybe a little more selfish acts, a little more hedonism. Maybe some more heroin, says Brian.
I will say that there's like a 1-to-1 correlation between infatuation with White Claws and coronavirus. So I'm not going to say that the one is orchestrated by the other, but if I could have had a time machine and bought stock in White Claw.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Yeah. Justin, what can you think of any maybe something in the realm of this podcast's purview?
Oh, I mean, what you see is everybody saying that nature is healing, Bryce. You know, you have all the animals are now venturing out to places that they wouldn't have otherwise because there's not so many people mucking it up for them.
Actually, serious answer. If I'm hearing you right, Justin, you're talking about we've seen some pictures of like smog covered cities that are now clear and fish that are swimming in cleaner waters and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But if I was going to point to one thing slightly political is that the U.S. in particular has a long history of taking pride in the fact that we like to move very slowly on allowing medical trials to happen because, you know, for safety's sake. And there have been a number of times that that has worked in our favor. For example, thalidomide was not the disaster here in the United States that it was in the 1960s in Europe because we had a longer vetting period for new drugs. Man, that seems all out the window right now with COVID. It's just like, who wants to voluntarily sign up for crazy ass COVID vaccines? Say yeah. So I think that might be a weird silver lining is that America seems to be opening itself up to the idea of voluntary crazy experimentation of things.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
Well, I think, I don't know. I don't know if the experimentation per se is different, but certainly the approval of those are rapidly sped up. I think you still probably need to experiment the same number. It's just a matter of how many experiments you have to do and how long you have to wait to make sure that somebody didn't die 6 months later from taking your drug.
Okay. I'd say pretty good. Any other last guesses here? I think in medical is kind of a close here. Any other last thoughts before we show you the thing?
We all casually glance over at Andrew. Here's my vote. Is 6 months ago, the stated biggest epidemic to be fixed was vaping. Now the stated thing to be fixed is an actual disease. Yeah, and I'd rather that we're focused on something besides e-cigarettes.
Yeah, the stated epidemic to fix was a thing that was saving the lives of thousands of smokers.
Yeah.
You know, I'm rather, I mean, there's nothing to be jazzed about, but it seems to me like,
That is definitely the war on vaping is our new like Britney Spears with the snake in like the nation longs to care about stupid BS again, like that Onion cover.
The war on vaping was the summer of the shark. And then 9/11 happened and we were like, why were we even talking about sharks? What was that?
Yeah. New York City banning sodas. You know, that was
sodas. Oh, my God. That was Bloomberg's big thing. He took on big sodas and made us buy two smaller sodas. That was his greatest achievement.
So positive things have happened. Like clearly, like from a, there's an argument made from a health point of view. We've talked about this before that because of the rapid advancements, the push towards fast developments, infectious diseases were probably far fewer people are going to die in the next few decades from infectious diseases than before, because we've accelerated so much development and taken this seriously. So we know that. The idea of telemedicine at home, the lifting of the restrictions allowed you to talk to your doctor and do that via Skype, which people didn't realize you couldn't do before. That's amazing.
Along that same line, can I double down on that and say that millions of parents are realizing that their children are being sent to school allegedly to be taught all day, but there's only about 90 minutes of learning those kids are doing every single day. Everything else is daycare and socializing or whatever, which I understand we can't constantly have our kids with us all the time. But I don't think as a society there's been in 100 years a moment that parents have had to face that fact more head on than right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would say that I know I read an article the other day that talked about the helium shortage is kind of an exposed for not being the shortage that we thought it was.
Yeah, so with party balloons and parties, demand for parties dropping off of a cliff, per this Physics Today.
Oh, did you land on it?
Helium shortage has ended. At least for now.
I found the article.
He sent me that one last night.
Okay, all right.
So people may know party balloons accounted for about 10% of worldwide helium demand. And now that there are less parties happening, there is more helium freed up for scientists and medical engineers. Though, interestingly, costs have not really come down per some of the reports, despite the fact that supply is in much greater demand. Right now, the U.S. outputs about 68 million cubic meters of helium and uses about 40 million cubic meters. Let's see. There's also... I still don't know if this is a shortage or a windfall of helium either, right? Because this is
so
possibly temporary. Yeah.
Just briefly, the helium shortage is one of those kind of very poorly understood things. And there is a limit to the amount of natural resources on our planet. Absolutely. Planets, certain size, what have you, and certain things other than like meteor rock just don't come back. Helium, the helium you use today is a byproduct generally from natural gas production. You get a bunch of natural gas, you actually find there's going to be helium in the same areas in which you're procuring your natural gas from. It's expensive to get the helium from natural gas, but it's there. And we now have the largest amounts of natural gas reserves we way exceeded whatever expectations we've had on natural gas. Nobody really talks about noticing more about an oil shortage or anything like that. You know, it's 2020. We were supposed to run out of everything. And now we found out like, wow, the people who said we're going to have more of it than we ever realized were right. And because helium... like it comes from natural gas, the ability to get it's there. It's just always been the cost. It wasn't cost effective because we controlled the prices of helium. We'd say this is the price. This is what you sell it for, whatever. The government would sell it at below a certain rate because of the National Helium Reserve, et cetera. I'm trying to simplify things, but basically we never had a shortage. What we had was we had an artificial market, which created an artificial scarcity. And then people were like, oh, run out of helium. Well, yes, in a million year term, yes, we are running out of helium. In the next 10,000 years, absolutely not. It's just not cheap, because it takes some amount of effort to extract it. And now there's been a fall in demand on helium because less party balloons, other stuff. And now people are like, oh, I can get helium now. I can get it for my experiments and stuff. It's cheaper now. And so, the hard part.
I'm gonna say two things that are true. It is scary to think about the fact that the only way to get more helium on planet Earth is to invent a better form of fusion and take two hydrogens and make a helium or whatever, which is right now very, very energy intensive or whatever. So you could truly, fairly, in your mind, think of helium as a truly limited resource. Separately,
I could say the same about hydrogen. Hydrogen.
Correct. Even though it's the most abundant thing in the universe, right? Separately, and this is
helium being the second most abundant.
Correct. Separately, this is a fact that every time I say it out loud, I sound even to my own ears as a crazy person. The planet has never, ever, ever run out of any non-renewable resource. We've run out of many renewable resources because we overtaxed, overfarmed, weren't able to replicate enough of them or whatever. There are things that have gone extinct or whatever. But humanity has never, ever run out of a single non-renewable resource. Sounds so wrong coming out of my own dumb face, but seems to be the case. If anyone has a counterexample, let me know.
Yeah, there's a great, if you go to Wikipedia, look abundance of the chemical elements and you see within the universe, the abundance of things, and even go within our own solar system. Hydrogen is, the most abundant and helium is the second. And by the way, helium, if you look at the ratio of like mass fraction in parts per million, hydrogen, 705,000, helium, 275,000, third, oxygen, 9,000. Like there is like 20 times as much helium in our solar system as there is oxygen.
On Earth, it's different, but again, it's pretty important.
It's overrated. It's just mostly just a, what you're used to. You're thinking of air, which is mostly nitrogen. We don't even know if we need the oxygen, really.
Yeah.
One of the other interesting parts of, of this article is, so like Andrew mentioned, liquefied natural gas tends to be how we get a lot of our helium, because helium is a byproduct of that process. But as the demand for fossil fuel goes down, they are advising prospectors to look for helium alone, not just natural gas, but just helium, deposits.
Can I just say that I had forgotten that prospectors are still a thing, and I just had this wonderful image of a guy with a pickaxe being told, now here's where you want to go, find yourself a Chuck E. Cheese, there's lots of helium around there because there's always having parties.
He's got a donkey too. Don't forget the donkey. Always
going, your pots and pans clanging. Yeah,
he's got the overalls, but only one of them is tied, and it's tied to the other shoulder. It's a cross.
His name's Pete.
There is one company, Helium One, that is looking to develop a few locations in the Tanzania Rift Valley, where they've detected helium gases. There, they believe that the gases are about 10% helium. Compared to other locations where they extract helium, where it can be 0.3 and 0.1% helium. So as prospectors start looking for helium-specific sites, we might see even more of a supply readily available.
Right now, we have, quote-unquote, plenty of helium, and it's all just dandruff from another product that we really care about in the form of LNG, liquid natural gas, right?
Partially, I believe, yeah.
And I remember, like, but Brian, also, like, we're constantly producing helium in our core from radioactive decay. So,
now,
you know.
This is new to me. I thought that all the helium we had just happened to be trapped. I was not aware that we had any way to create new helium outside of fusing two hydrogens on purpose. Talk to me more about the core decay.
Well, because our core is radioactive, and as part of the decay, one of the byproducts it gives off is helium. So that's one of the other places that it's being produced. But most of the stuff that you have, like, yeah, it actually came from when the solar system formed. That's where it came from. But, and that the amount of helium there is, you know, we're going to be mining, you know, helium in space clouds and stuff before we ever have to worry about running out of it on Earth. You know, and it was one of those, to me, it was always sort of frustrating because you would hear, I'd see scientific, you know, outlets, news media, whatever, talk about, oh, the helium, we're running out. It's like, no, you're not. You know, talk to somebody, you know, you're running out of their cheap helium, people willing to make it cheaply. Is there, we're not running out of helium, it's just the easy to get like anything else, and there's just not a big enough market for somebody to, but now, like Bryce pointed out, Helium One, they're like, yeah, no, we're looking at, like, we think there's enough of a market, we'll go do it. It's one of the reasons why people have gone like, oh, like literally people thought about, like, maybe we don't build airships because helium is expensive and we're not going to get any more helium. It's like, well, maybe if we had airships, we would be increasing our helium production and just mining specific helium, and then problem solved.
Yeah, not to crawl too far into our own butts, but this does tend to be one of our favorite topics to come back to, is the world being more abundant than you would intuitively think. You know, we talked about how aluminum used to be so extraordinarily rare that Napoleon, you know, had forks and knives made out of it. Nowadays, it's so cheap that, you know, it's cheaper than tin or what have you. I'll be curious what happens when we figure out a brand new, super exciting, really good use for helium, how that'll change things.
Yeah, and whippets don't count. And just a side note, the way to look at it is, one of the reasons why we were hesitant to use oil in any sort of mass scale was that oil used to be a thing that you just found on the surface pools. You know, you go somewhere and you'd find a little pond of oil. Like, oh, look, there's some oil there. Yay, there's oil. That's cool stuff. You got to refine it. It's a pain in the ass, but I guess it's worth it. But it's not like all these whales we have, right. You know, that we can go get, you
where
know,
it already has
from.
The perfect right type of fuel to put in these, you know, buckets to light on fire.
Yeah. And then somebody's like, we'll just take this oil out of these, you know, these puddles and ponds. And we have, oh, there's bubbling up a little more. Okay, that's cool. But, you know, we're going to run out of these. There's only so many of these ponds and lakes filled with oil, you know, and then you're done. And then somebody's like, what if we drilled a hole? Like, oh, wow, there's more oil here. And they're like, yeah, but those were running out of oil, those holes. And somebody's like, what if we dug a deeper hole? No, it won't be down there. You're not going to find it. There's nothing to be found there. It's a waste of your time. Holy cow, there's a lot of oil here. Like, yeah, but then some of it's in rocks and stuff. Like, what if we use the material to sort of separate the rocks and create fractures? Ah, it's expensive, won't be worth it. And like, oh my God, now we have more than we need ever.
Yeah, man. And now we're at a point where, like we've just lost. It's become, oil has become boring in our lifetime. Like, who cares?
Yeah.
One last story here. We gotta give a shout out to a real one. If I say the name Saturn, what do you think of?
I wish his name was Happy Earn.
Troubled professional wrestler Perry Saturn.
GM trying to innovate out the Japanese, but not
Sega overrunning its market share.
Oh, okay, sure. The Sega Saturn.
My prog rock band from 1978 that I don't talk about.
A car, whether I'm not certain, still exists.
That was the GM thing.
The GM
Saturn. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right.
We tap out.
Wait, no. There's got to be other Saturns. Come on.
Okay.
No, Brian, Saturn. We said the ball. That's all.
Vessel holding the desiccated corpse of a loved one that also is imbued with the power of emotions.
Saturn.
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's where I mean.
A Saturn.
That's where I was all going. Right. Yeah. All right.
Well, we're tapping out now.
You might know Saturn as the second oldest alligator. You may also have heard the tall tale that Saturn, who has just recently passed away, was Hitler's pet alligator. Now, that is a tall tale with no proven track record of being true at all, but that is the story everyone...
What is complicated about that legacy? That is...
I avoided this story because it wasn't even like old Hitler. There was just so nothing to it, but it was like clearly... it's fine. I'm glad you did. Just was like... Mm-hmm. Very disappointing to find out this is not Hitler's alligator.
It's not?
No.
That's the complication.
That is part of it. It's funny.
It's like finding out that the Tiger King's tigers didn't belong to him.
Yeah. In a way.
Certainly don't anymore.
In this Vice article, Hitler's alligator leaves behind complicated legacy at a Moscow zoo. It's not until like the final paragraph where they say, it's not even, no one has any proof that this is Hitler's. It just so happened to be that Saturn was in the Berlin Zoo since 1936, or he was shipped to the Berlin Zoo after he was born in 1936 and survived World War II before spending his days in a Moscow zoo. And I think that is where kind of the tall tale of, this might have been Hitler's alligator. I think at one point they even named him Hitler in the Moscow Zoo very briefly until they landed on the name Saturn.
There is sort of like whether or not Jumbo was the world's biggest elephant, it is a fact that that elephant lived a life being marketed as the world's biggest elephant. And even in its afterlife, Jumbo was taken on tour as two copies of Jumbo, one being taxidermied outside of Jumbo, the other being the skeleton of Jumbo. Mm-hmm. So it's like at some point, the question of whether or not it was Hitler's alligator ceases to be the most interesting part of the story. The fact is, it lived and toured as that.
Yeah. In fact, Saturn will be stuffed and placed on display at the State Darwin Museum, a biology museum in Moscow. So Saturn is likely the world's second oldest alligator of all time. The first is belonging to an alligator that is still alive called Muja in Serbia.
Okay.
Muja's just stunting on everybody. Mm-hmm. Still alive.
How old do you think Muja is, Justin?
Well, I just looked at the.
Oh, doggone it. Okay. What was the answer?
It was hatched around 1936. So, math your way to now.
Well, so Saturn was hatched in the wild in Mississippi in 1936. Muja was reported to have already been an adult alligator in 1936. So while there's no exact date, they do believe it to be older than Saturn.
Damn. Well, why don't they just ask him?
So there's the stories for the week. Anybody got some picks?
I just want to picture one of these alligators like responding to a Facebook quiz that says only 30 alligators will know this reference.
Yeah.
The green thumbs up emoticon. All right. Got any picks, anybody?
Yeah, hey, social credit score. We were talking about that. It reminded me of an episode of Community that I saw last night called Meow Meow Beans. It's very funny. And I am continually delighted after suffering through season five, after like the first two episodes, really, really, really have gotten on track. And the Meow Meow Beans episode was particularly prescient, considering the issue that they are talking about, where the entire school gets caught up in a new beta tested app where all you do is just rate your friends 1 through 5 constantly. Is that a social caste system develops wherein 5s have lives, 4s have chores, 3s have fleas, 2s have blues, and 1s don't get a rhyme because they're garbage.
That was one of those episodes I thought was one of things Community doing what it does really well, building a crazy world within this world of like, hey, we have a community college environment. Mm-hmm. You know, let's build a really crazy world there. And yeah, they've done that wonderfully. So that was always where it was sort of the most fun.
Yeah. Very cool. That looks like it's called App Development and Condiments.
So I don't know what they've put in the water, but boy, is Spotify convincing me to listen to more and more Spotify original podcasts, the latest of which is called
Brian, shut your mouth, is called
Wind of Change. Do you have any of you guys heard of this?
About farting?
No. It is about the assertion, the thesis, the opening serial music plays. I'm Justin Robert Young, and I have one question.
I host Serial now.
Was the 1990 hair metal hit Wind of Change by the Scorpions actually written by the CIA? Somehow we're going to get 8 episodes out of this. It's me, Justin Robert Young. Huh. And so everything I said sounds dumb, and it is, but and some amount of it is just talking about the band Scorpion. Some amount of it, though, is an awesome deep dive into some of the weird wetworks activities that the CIA has done over the years. The second episode talks about how they recruited jazz musicians to put American jazz and make it popular throughout the world or whatever. But the specific question is a little bit ridiculous. The question of that sweet, sweet whistling hook that all of us know, was that a government plot? And the answer so far is maybe. I'm really enjoying it.
Interesting, because I know there's a lot that we know of in terms of, say, the Department of Defense, right? Like, the Department of Defense funds a lot of creative projects, right? They put a lot of money into, like, sporting events, which is kind of why, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's why we do the national anthem at football events or sporting events in general, is because of influence from the military.
Yes and no. There, specifically with football, there was a big thing where the Department of Defense was paying to have members of the military like on the field and stuff like that. But I don't know if maybe there's like a history of these programs, and that's why we do the Pledge of Allegiance and stuff, or the national anthem rather, at the beginning of sporting events from the very beginning, but that specific issue was was something that was about the NFL stadium. Oh no, and the flyovers. The flyovers. The flyovers. Like, that was like also part of the flyovers.
Or just like funding movies, right? Funding movies to have pro military slants on them.
It is funny to have it flip from the very serious topic of, you know, the Cold War. Like one 15-minute segment will be explaining about a lost Soviet sub that had nuclear armaments on it, and how they realized that the U.S. had found it before they before the Russians even knew that the U.S. had found it. They needed to cover it up by contacting Howard Hughes to make up a fake project that involved going and creating a boat big enough to just, you know, send down a crane claw like you're trying to win a stuffed animal, only you get half of a nuclear sub. So you get this very serious stuff, and then you get, you know, just tonal shift of like, but let's talk about the Scorpions. And this is what their music usually sounds like. Isn't it weird that this one ballad would come out of this? Also, let's hear that whistling hook and tell the story of the time that somebody came to his hotel room, said, "I'm from the CIA. Please whistle Wind of Change. Thank you. Bye." Which is apparently something that happens. It's a really weird, wonderful ride. I think you guys will like it.
Whoa. Very cool. Winds of Change.
Yeah, I was look up the Glomar Explorer, and that's just a crazy sort of thing where Hughes got paid like $300 million to build this boat to recover a submarine.
As a matter of fact, they explain that was the incident that created the phrase "can neither confirm nor deny." That never existed until this was the incident that made the CIA come up with that response. And the guy, you know, the Justin Robert Young host of this podcast, who's on a mission, he gets glomered. He eventually pushes back against the FOIA dismissal and says, "No, this is fairly, what you're saying doesn't make sense." And then finally, he gets a letter that says, "We will neither confirm nor deny that we wrote the song Winds of Change. This is our final exchange."
Wow.
Crazy. Well, again, that's also the habit of, like, one, you never confirm or deny just about anything. Two, sometimes they don't know. You know, like, there's even, you know, there may have been.
Oh, yeah.
There is, like, there are CIA projects that fund startups that work in, let's say, encryption. And, like, not breaking them, but, like, creating stuff. Like, I knew somebody was involved with one of these. It was a VC firm funded by the CIA. And I'm not talking conspiracy. Like, this is, like, a legit, like, head of company, whatever. Like, oh, yeah, we've got the project we're doing with, you know, the CIA, where we're doing venture capital in sort of area. I'm like, it's, like, insane. It's, like, insane. But then you go around the D.C., Virginia area, and you see lots of companies and crazy things, and that there could be, like, Patriot Music Publishing. You know, could be a name.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure. There might be like a CIA company or organization funding ranchera music in Latin America and stuff to try to, for whatever purpose and stuff.
Well, there's equally bizarre stories like before he was assassinated, Kennedy recognized that we needed to stop the Cold War. And Khrushchev also understood that. And so he gave this one particular impassioned speech about ending the Cold War. And on the Russian side, they intentionally unjammed the Voice of America radio stations of that speech because they were like, this is the greatest case to end the Cold War that we could think of. And then, you know, things got a little bit nutty. Other things happened. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I got a pick. So this came out a couple weeks ago, and I've enjoyed it, and I've gone back to it many, many, many times. It's getting to be summertime, and I don't know if the song of the summer is quite on this album, but I do think that this is a really fantastic one. It is the new Lady Gaga album, Chromatica. I think this is a great album. I think that this is like a big, big return to form. It's all dance music. I'd say there are a few down tempo songs, but I wouldn't even say that there's a ballad on the album. It's great. It is very house music inspired. It is very 90s, kind of like late 80s French house or Italian house music inspired. But I think it's great. I really think it's great, and it's worth listening to, even if you're not a diehard Lady Gaga fan. Specifically, if you're looking for picks, I think the Ariana Grande feature. That's a joke for Brian and Justin. The Ariana Grande feature, Rain On Me, is very good. That's got a really cool music video. I also think that Replay is a lot of fun. Also, the weirdest one for me on the album, and I like it, is called Babylon, which is, boy, it sounds a lot like Madonna's Vogue.
But it's about the series of articles titled The Richest Man in Babylon. So the lyrics are like, save 10% of all you make. They're like soldiers working for you. Come on, save. Save your money and become rich. Is that kinda?
it's about gossip, but it's
it gets to the part she just lists off all the Lincoln, Franklin, Hamilton, Washington. She just names presidents who are on bills. Never mind.
There we go. I think it's a very cool album. I've been playing it nonstop pretty much for the past 2 weeks, and it's shifting. I think that it's a good sign of an album where my favorites keep shifting. You know, the stuff that I really didn't like on my first listen, I've like grown to really enjoy, and then the stuff I liked at first, I'm seeing what sort of depth there are to it. I think it's really great. I think it's really cool. So, Chromatica from Lady Gaga. Andrew, you got a pick?
I've got sort of two things to talk about. Awesome. First is like, man, I watch McMillions.
sorry. Say it again. It's funny every time you say it because only one of us on the panel made it all the way to the end on purpose. Go ahead. Say it again. I love it.
I'm going to use my stock joke here. And again, working with networks is crazy. And I don't want to blame anybody because who knows? I'm just going to say, this is what I said before. Like, I felt like I got a harsher sentence than the people in the show did for what they did by having to sit through all McMillions. Like, you get to the end of it and you're like, yeah, it's what I read in the Atlantic article or wherever it was.
Yeah. It's not that long of a story. It's not a 6-hour story.
Oh my God.
Turns out the fast food game was crooked. Is that the pitch? Nope, that's the whole story.
Yeah.
Who was it? Yeah. We already knew.
Who's stealing these pieces? I don't know. Maybe the guy that you assigned to hide the pieces?
It's maybe the guy who keeps winning.
Stealing the pieces.
It's the guy whose entire family keeps winning the damn thing.
Well, yeah. I mean,
why are all these people? And they talk to a reporter who is like, we probably should have realized the fact that everybody was winning was in like the southeastern United States from like 100-mile radius. maybe.
You know, when I read the article, I was like, the more we've talked about it, the more I'm realizing like, oh, it's like when you find out the method to a magic trick. It's mm-hmm. like the most exciting you ever are in the story is one guy kept winning the McDonald's Monopoly thing. And all you think of is every time you went and got two of the pieces but could never get the third, and all the stories of like, oh, you know, they spread them out all over the country and you'd really have to go across the country if you wanted to even have a chance. And so you start thinking, much in the same way that you would when you see a magic trick, all the wrong possible things. And then when you find out that the method is like, oh no, it's a hidden thing. It's just like, oh, well, that's a lot less interesting than like me thinking of this like crazy guy who's figured out the mathematics probability and like, is like winning and like cracked this code.
It's
petty theft.
Yes. It's 8-hour long episodes of
six.
How that chicken was able to beat you at tic-tac-toe at the fair. Yeah.
Like the most obvious thing would be the guy in charge of securing the pieces is the one who did it.
And it's a story that involves one of the guy who was his fence for helping him move him was a member of the Columbo crime family. Mm. And you're like, oh, yeah. Great, this is getting interesting. We're going to go a deep dive into this. No, we're going to talk about Columbo's wife and her, you know, her passion for crazy, dressing like a crazy Italian lady. That's it. That's
his
it.
Name
that's all you're going to get.
Was Cornelius, found on a farm in the outskirts of Western Ohio. Oh. But first, we need to learn, how does tic-tac-toe work? When is it played?
Who plays tic-tac-toe? Why?
That's my warning sign when, like, I pick up like a when I pick up a biography that's like a 400 page. I'm like, oh, good. Walt Elias Disney's great 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 grandfather. Like, screw you. Like I don't. That has nothing to do with him at all. You know, and like you're like 100 pages in. And then when his great, you know, his aunt, you're like, this is not you. You just didn't have anything to say.
Man, I had that with one of the Barry Goldwater books that I read, where it's like the first three chapters are just like all about his great great grandparents, and it's like I was writing a script this weekend, and I'm like, yeah, that's definitely a sentence. Like, descended from the people that founded Phoenix. And we're good.
Well,
like,
Webster's Dictionary defines tic-tac-toe as a game played in a grid.
Yeah, my rule of thumb on that is
tic-tac-toe, also known as crosses and knots, originated.
My rule of thumb on, like, should you include it, like, hey, if you were later on into the story, would you mention this as a flashback? And like, oh, no, it'd slow things down. And I'm like, yeah, leave
that
it out.
It's not important. Yeah.
So I watched on HBO did a documentary, Inventor, the story Out for Blood, the story of Theranos. And
before you
Elizabeth
continue,
Holmes.
just to put a button on it. How excited would all of us be for a documentary about the making of McMillions?
No.
And if it was only like 10 minutes or something.
Because it's two Queeby, people call me. In a con. It's in a conference room with two people. We just got a call from HBO. They're short. Like, you know, Watchmen didn't get the audience they wanted, and they really need content. Can you stretch this three into six? Yeah, we'll make it work. We've got some extra footage. Done. Okay. Hey, editor, make this into six. Okay. You know, that's it.
Yeah.
It's not like a lot of creativity went into it. You know? So I did like the other HBO documentary I did like, which was an Alex Gibney documentary. I like it with a couple asterisks here. It was about Elizabeth Holmes. She was the creator of the company Theranos, which was supposed to do all these amazing blood tests. And it's a great example of, like, she had people like that got that company had like billions in financing, or you know, hundreds of millions of financing, a valuation of like $9 billion. She had, if you look at her board of advisors, it was an incredible array of people across the political, you know, spectrum. George Shultz, okay? You had Richard Mathis. You had just these incredible. Her attorney was David Boies, who was Al Gore's attorney during the recount. Her assistant was Hillary Clinton's assistant. I mean, and it was right and left. She had all these political figures from everywhere. And then people, like, I had a friend, and I got to call him out on this. He's like, yeah, there was really no sign that she was a fraud. And I'm like, no, the sign that she was a fraud, all of her advisors were political and business people and not scientists. That's the thing. When she's got this most innovative thing and there's not her board of advisors is not people she's accumulated over the years, that's symptomatic of fraud. Or the idea that why won't this person who's known you the longest work with this? Why aren't these people in these fields excited to work with you about this? It's because it's kind of, that's one of the you look at the omission, what's missing there. People like, oh no, she had all these amazing people. Like, yeah, who knew jack all nothing about science? It's a really neat documentary. I would say that if anything, the thing that's frustrating, they don't go into the early years. And also is the fact that she started this company at 19, and her business partner, I'm going to pull up the name of this guy, who gets a little bit of attention here, but not anywhere near as much as you should think, because he's this older guy who had helped start a company before. And it's kind of like Ramesh Sunny Balwani. I'm like, way too little focus on him, because how does this 19-year-old woman create this billion-dollar organization? It does not happen. Nobody does that by themselves, particularly a 19-year-old. You do that by being enabled, and they just did not go anywhere enough into Balwani, which I thought was like, there's much more going on here. Mm. So
cool.
That's my pick, but still enjoyed it. I wish they did that. I could have watched six episodes on. That would have been great.
This is this also, from the guy who did Going Clear also?
Yeah, Alex Gibney, yeah. What?
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. Gibney does a lot of stuff. Like, oh. he is fairly prolific.
Hmm. Yeah. There we go.
And then I watched Space Force.
Space Force is all right. All right.
For audio listeners, there was a very dismissive Andrew headshake.
Let me tell you how much I love Greg Daniels' new show, Upload. That was amazing. I loved Upload. Upload was really fun. Upload's a great example when you're grounded, when you know what your reality is, and your expectations from scene to scene don't shift dramatically because at one point you're watching a cartoon, and the next moment you're supposed to have something that has a lot of gravitas. That's why I loved Upload so much. And that's what's important about comedy, is consistent characters, consistent understanding the comedies, and jokes that land.
Yeah. I'll say about Space Force. Space Force is out at a weird time where... Steve Carell's character, who is the head of the new Space Force, is definitely like portrayed as kind of an oaf who doesn't know what he's doing and isn't in actual control. And yet, in the first two or three episodes I've seen, he still like wins, and everyone congratulates and praises him for winning, which I think is always a very tough thing to be like. I think it works when you're Michael Scott and you're in a comp and it's like, oh, it's the company. But when you're like, here's dumb bureaucrats and it's all just, confidence grit.
It's you go from like, he's like, let's use a bomb to solve this. Da, 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 da. My daughter needs help with the trigonometry homework. Let me go explain this to her. And you're like, wait a second. Are you a dumb guy? Or are you a smart guy?
Right.
And then it was the same problem with season one of Parks and Rec, where they made her too dumb. And then they realized, no, she's not likable. We've got to bring her up. And so by season two, she was competent. And they just, let's just amp up her enthusiasm and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's a show where it's like at the beginning, they're like, hey, the joke's like, oh, yeah, we got to land on the moon in 2024. I roll. Oh, what a dumb idea. Spoiler alert, end of the season, within the first year, they landed on the moon. Oop. So I'm like, so what are you saying? That was actually a genius idea? And then it's like
it's bizarre. You know, like the first episode, the whole thing is like, should we launch this rocket today or not? And he wants to do it because there are all these representatives from DC there. But the scientists are saying, no, we shouldn't do it. We should push it to tomorrow. But all the DC people are going to be gone. And he spends the entire day like fighting with his scientists saying like, no, no, we can do it. Fine. We can just believe. The power of belief will make us science it better. And then when it launches, fine. Then he's like, he's sharing a whiskey with his scientist who is like, yeah, I gotta tell you, you really made the right call. No, he didn't. That's not how that stuff works at all.
And an aside too is that part of the premise is like, it starts off where he gets assigned, he's going to be head of Space Force, and his wife is played by Lisa Kudrow, and then she could see she's not happy. They fast forward a year later, she's in federal prison. That's part of the storyline. His wife is in federal prison. We never know why. It's a 40 to 60 year sentence. They never tell us why.
Oh, really?
And you're like, yeah. And I'm like, in what world, unless I missed an episode, I'm like, in what world do you put the head, do you make a guy who's head of a major military branch of the military and his wife gets convicted for a felony for a life sentence in jail? And everybody's just okay with it. It's just okay. Yeah. And it's just sort of a little minor thing. I'm like, and that's my problem is like, you can have a world that's crazy, like, you know,
pick
you can
one.
Do a crazy story. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like Upload works wonderfully well because the world is crazy, but the people are sane. The people in Upload are sane and they're trying to navigate a crazy world. And when you have comedy where all of a sudden, you know, The Office worked because you was a normal world and you had this chaos agent, Michael Scott. You know, and Dwight, who was a bit weird, but other than that, you had really normal people there doing normal stuff and not like, I'm going to be a wacky person and make wacky choices and stuff. So, no, they never explained why. And so you're going like,
I think that's,
how am I supposed to know what to care for here?
Yeah, I think it's very funny to say Lisa Kudrow is a part of this cast and she's just in jail for some reason. I think that's kind of funny there. I think it's funny. I'm only like two or three episodes in. So it's funny to know that they don't touch on that.
also, another thing too is it wasn't until the first two episodes we never had two characters interact other than to exchange lines of dialogue about the Nair, you know, Michael's the
space
Steve Carell's character,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
there was the third episode that we finally started to get other character storylines and stuff. And that was the thing I'm watching this with my girlfriend. I'm like, this is problematic because like they've defined his relationship to everybody else, but we don't know how this works when he's not there. And then when he's not there, the only sort of the best you sort of get is like, you know, his daughter having troubles. Like, and it's hard to this is a show that we're supposed to cheer a father for leaving the room when we're in the middle of like an international crisis that could lead to World War III, so he can go talk to his daughter about, you know, how she's having trouble adjusting. And you're like, he's horrible. This is horrible.
Yeah, it's a weird one. Yeah.
Yeah. John Malkovich, though, amazing.
He's great.
Malkovich is always amazing.
He's awesome. That's going to do it here for Weird Things Today. For Andrew, Brian, and Justin, I'm Bryce, and it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.